Morning!
Morning!
Welcome to the India Explained podcast, recorded in London and San Francisco. One take, unscripted, no rehearsal.
Hey Bunty, greetings from San Francisco. How's things with you in London?
Things are good, Rohit. Today, I went to watch cricket at the Oval. Every summer, I see one test match or part of a test match either at Lord's or Oval. This time I couldn't get tickets for Lord's because of Ashes, so I've just come back today and England have squared up the series, which was really good to watch. And obviously I had gone for the, as I told you, India-Pakistan earlier on, and I tweeted. I don't know, but just randomly, I put Instagram posts on our feed, pictures, every time I go, so just shouting out to folks who are listening. If you check that feed out, it's India Explained Why. It's our Instagram feed. But Rohit also posts sometimes. I post, you know, it's not a massive thing, but sometimes. So, yeah, sorry, rambled. But that's where I've come back from. So, what did I talk about then, Rohit?
So, I thought there was a lot happening. Let's try something a little new. We'll do this intermittently. Let's call it Just Another Week in India. Okay, so Just Another Week in India. I'm just going to throw a few things out, which you and I have been corresponding about as we do through the course of the week. So, you know, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. Actually, there's very little good. It's more like the dark, the grim, and, you know, the absurd. So I'd say that in the first category of the dark and the grim, the economy is in a really terrible shape. And we now know that, bad allergies. We now know that, you know, that historic blunder of demonetization was the primary mover of that. The government is scrambling to, you know, cover it with some optics and then a very poorly implemented goods and services tax, which otherwise was not a bad idea, again, was also a contributing factor. After the abrogation of Article 370, Kashmir continues to be under siege. By the way, I was interviewed by Iona, who had also interviewed me on a couple of topics earlier for Argentinian magazine. So that I'll share that link when that comes up. And it was a podcast that she does for a magazine she's affiliated with, which is Argentina-based, on the Kashmir issue. So those are the two, I'd say, sort of, you know, grimmest things. And then usually there's, you know, some nonsense of some BJP MLA or MP, I don't know, in Madhya Pradesh, where there's a Congress government. He said that outlets that are selling milk should not also be selling eggs because milk is from the cow, cow is vegetarian, I don't know, some rubbish. So the usual nonsense. And then you send me this odd story of some dude in Surat wants to organize a farting competition.
yes. So many things to talk about, bro. Let's very quickly dip into the economy that you mentioned. But look, I think the finance minister has been making a set of pronouncements around why the economy has been underperforming. And what has come to has become kind of a meme in the internet that, you know, you can almost blame really random things. The size of the cauliflowers, you know, there's too much potato in aloo parathas. Those are the kind of rationales that are being floated for underperforming of the Indian economy. I don't think at this present moment, the middle classes are feeling the pinch, right? There's been some amount of insulation. But I think, and I may be wrong, Rohit, but I think...
That's a very good point. I think
it's only a matter of time, or in 6 to 12-month window, then all of a sudden the essentials prices will go up, job opportunities will freeze, and this whole trading class, people who survive, which is essentially the BJP's kind of constituency, they suddenly realize that people don't have the money to buy, and that's hitting them.
It's already happening,
isn't it? Because the other day I thought there was some piece that I read, Vikas Puri traders like contemplating suicide because sales are down. So you've had it with farmers. All I'm saying is that whatever the finance minister does is in time going to cascade down to other segments of the population. And that's my... And obviously, Chidambaram's in jail. And one shout out to, you know, I don't know, the people have been saying on the connection with the economy because he was the previous finance minister. That's something that we have to shout out as well, that, you know, for all his protestations and dhoti wearing, he's been slammed. I do not know whether that's vindictiveness or whether there's some hera-feri involved, but your facts are what they are. Over to you for the economic bit.
Well, I think you're right. First of all, when you say middle classes, in India, it includes a very wide range of people. So the term is used at the one end of the spectrum to really include people who are elites also. So the professional middle classes, I think, haven't, you know, many of whom may not have been part of the BJP's traditional voting base, but have been great admirers of Modi for the last 8-10 years. I guess because, you know, it's sort of sanctified their banal bigotry, or, you know, they've taken in by this idea of, like, India needs a strong leader, Hinduism shouldn't be apologetic anymore. They're not hit yet. The farmers have been hit for a long time. The trading class has now been hit. But what's going to happen is, let's say the dollar jumps to 90, then you have the professional, salaried, you know, senior level executive. Once the dollar goes to 90, 95, then suddenly he may not have enough money to send his son or daughter to some, you know, obscure college in the middle of America for an undergrad degree, right? Because he or she could not make that absurd 99.95 cutoff at Delhi University or whatever. That's when that class is also going to turn. But, you know, I think I did a tweet, we did a tweet about this, that it takes a rare talent to inherit a booming economy and then just, you know, drive it into the ground. Chidambaram, I don't know. I mean, the thing is that in general, politicians of any stripe, for the most part, you know, have a set of murky, opaque dealings, which one can say are at the very least unethical, if not outright illegal. But to me, that at least the way in which they're arresting people, it's very much a case of vendetta. I think the way the BJP bought out a lot of, like, politicians at the MLA level and the MP level was by essentially getting dirt on them and then telling them that, you know, if you don't defect to the BJP, this we'll just harangue you with cases forever or lock you up. And it's very clear that, you know, the judiciary and therefore the police also in relation are all sort of very heavily compromised. So they've completely corrupted and compromised the state apparatus, both at the federal level and at, you know, the sort of state level. I don't know the stories that they may have asked Chidambaram to join the BJP and then, you know, probably after that, get into the business of managing the economy and stemming the rot. And he may have just said no. I don't think the case is going to stick. I mean, they'll drag it out. He may be in jail, but that's what I
have to say. Look, I think you make a fair point. We don't have the full facts. You know, as it's been reported, Chidambaram stands accused of a massive amount of hera-feri, but this is a projection, right? And, you know, I think what holds in court is your innocence till proven guilty. But I think given that given these kind of things will happen in public life, and we, as you said, sometimes it feels like a vendetta. But by the same token, we have to give that operating space where if people have made this accusation, this guy should defend himself. And if he's guilty, you know, we call it out. And if he's not, then, you know, the writing's on the wall that this government operates in a kind of a vendetta. But, you know, as you say, the facts are not true because or don't seem accurate. Let's see how that nets out. In the interest of time, Rohit, should we kind of just not sidestep, but, you know, move on to Kashmir, which is the other thing we want to talk about.
Absolutely. So much to unpack and so much to talk about. And to me, I think the point is that I think we should get back separately to the whole, or, you know, maybe that's too big a question for us to, you know, get into or manage in a single episode and part of an episode about, okay, should 370 have been abrogated or not? I mean, the more burning issue is that if the Kashmiris really want this and if they are so, you know, thrilled about Modi and Shah's plan for development, why have you cut off communication in the valley? Why are, you know, Farooq Abdullah and Omar Abdullah and Mehbooba Mufti under arrest still? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think my point on that is just listening to the social media commentary and news feeds and different opinions, there's one which says that this is a law that was put in place for a short amount of time. And a series of governments extended it, and the narrative has became that essentially you're indulging a people, when I say people, I mean Kashmiris, more than any other citizen in the Indian nation. And the right-wing spin on this is the abrogation of Article 370 makes a level playing field for every citizen. Right? That is the right-wing narrative. Mm. The
The counterpoint to that is that in doing so, what has happened is, in one fell swoop, something that had been an arrangement for 70 years and had sustained the unique status of Kashmir in the Indian constitution was taken away. So there's a kind of a constitutional argument that, you know, what you have done is not constitutional. And I think we should see, obviously, and it's causing, then you do that, and then you instantly put in place a series of kind of military, quasi-military practices and cut people's communications off. That's the bit that kind of has Gaurakshak written all over it. Because, you know, I could run with the argument that, you know, this is essentially a gesture to make arrangements equitable across every citizen, right? If that was it. But in doing so, if you then follow it up with paramilitary action and cutting off communication, that has Gaurakshak written all over it, and that's what bothers me. What's your take on it?
Well, yeah, I think I'm going to put a couple of points out there that I don't, first of all, agree with the consensus in the international press that, you know, there's India-occupied Kashmir and there's Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, because that assumes that there's been this independent entity called Kashmir with a distinct identity separate from the rest of India and Indian civilization or South Asian civilization forever. I mean, it's nonsense. It's a disputed territory. Shashi Tharoor pointed that out, then I think that's a fair thing to call it. A couple of points. One is that it's been a militarized zone for long. The Indian armed forces have been guilty of torture, disappearances. Absolutely. We've had a very dirty record out there. You know, you have these draconian laws in place which kind of gave the armed forces sweeping powers and also in some way immunized them from any kind of prosecution. So there's been, that scandal has been, you know, an ongoing scandal for decades. Complicating all this is the fact that Kashmiri nationalism, it's not a nationalism that has just simply used religion as an instrument. It is now a kind of Islamist extremist movement. And I think for some reason there's either ignorance on the part of the Western press or, you know, in the Indian context, it kind of dilutes the liberal case. Or if you look at South Asian academia, you know, one of the ways in which Indian academics prove their secular credentials is by, you know, showing that they, on the Muslim issue, they have a radically progressive stand. So at a personal level, they'll, you know, quote Ghalib and Fayez and talk about their Muslim friends. And then, you know, they will make a lot of awaj about Palestine and Kashmir. But the fact of the matter is that it's long ceased to be just a militant movement. It is a terrorist movement, what we call, you know, militancy, count sort of insurgents, etc., diplomatically. So that's also kind of part of the mess and the background. Now, I think both sides, there needs to be some kind of notion where they're held accountable. It's completely utopian and maybe impossible to implement in practice. But sort of going forward, I mean, the question is a complicated one, that on the one hand, India does have a historical and political claim to Kashmir. And my view, I should say, is just one view. The Kashmiris obviously do have, you know, I think a claim to be made about their autonomy. Pakistan's claim, in my view, is kind of the weakest, and it's contradicted by, you know, their own kind of hypocrisy and really appalling sort of treatment of, you know, the religious minorities and so on and so forth. Now, the question, though, is, you know, it also remains to be said that autonomy itself had been practically eviscerated. So it was really what we call autonomy was just a kind of symbol. But, you know, even symbols have some value. It just gave that illusion, or for whatever reason, it was still important to Kashmiris that, you know, they had some kind of distinctiveness in this and a particular kind of special arrangement, which was consistent with the larger policy of federalism. They are part of India and they've been assimilated, again, the big contradiction is exactly what you point out. Then why do they need to be forced to love India at gunpoint? That's the question.
Correct. I think, look, obviously we won't kind of bottom out on this topic, which has failed nation states for 70 years on the sidelines of a podcast. But I think what we are trying to do is hold up, you know, perceptions that we've picked up in commentary, public discourse. It is a tricky situation. And I think one of the, what is prompting things, there are certain state actors like Imran Khan, the prime minister, you know, state actor is the prime minister. And then there's another girl called Malala. What happens is in this, one very interesting side anecdote, Rohit, there are a lot of people of Pakistani origin in Britain who claim to be Kashmiri. So my story here is that if you add up the number of people who claim to be Kashmiri, other than, you know, loud-ass Pakistanis, you suddenly realize that Kashmir probably is as populous as, Indonesia, right? Yeah. Because so one of the things you realize is in the psychology of Pakistan and Pakistani people, and not all of them, but some of them, there's this huge Kashmiri fetish, right? Which I don't know where that comes from. And I think part of Malala's kind of ponderings on Kashmir, let kids go to school, this, that, the other, was, there are people who can't go to school or be prevented. Why don't you talk about them in that same voice?
Correct.
So what you are doing is you are focusing on a disputed area, territory, one portion of the disputed area, and summarizing people that your schools have been shut. Not for any moment am I suggesting that is the right thing to do. I made it clear that I don't think it's the right thing to cut off communications and have a parliamentary style environment there. But we shouldn't be taking sermons from people other sides of the border because, there's much more wrong going on there. And to your point about, leftist academia in India.
Academia in America, it's a really insufferable and tedious. And honestly, I mean, I think one of the best decisions I ever made was, I work in South Asian studies. I've, spent some time as a visiting scholar at Stanford South Asia Center, which was wonderful. It's really a terrific experience, great people. But I'm kind of happy that, I had a few tenure-track South Asian history positions, and these were in Research One universities, very prestigious research universities where, I would have had, more funds for research and lower teaching load than I do and so on. But I'm really very glad I didn't take those up. There were many reasons, personal and professional, and I won't sort of get into those or bore people. But so one reason, it may not have been the main reason by a long shot, but one reason was that, the vicious, this kind of groupthink, this consensus, and it comes out of a kind of largely Delhi-based model of, what secularism, activism is. It's a very paternalistic, elitist model in its own ways. And it's sort of monopolized and dictated in part by that JNU, Delhi University, and then to a lesser extent by, Jadavpur University. completely cliquish and, very nepotistic. People just,
We need to talk about it separately. Again, in the interest of time, just kind of move the needle along. You talked about this guy who was blaming chickens and cows for milk and eggs. What's the deal there?
Are he's saying that somehow he's quoting a cow and milk as a vegetarian thing.
Yeah.
And how milk is vegetarian, I don't know. It's an animal product. But anyway, the consensus is it's vegetarian. And his point is that milk should not be kept or sold in outlets along with the eggs and meat because vegetarians drink milk. As if people who eat meat don't drink milk. So it's typical BJP bakwas. I've seen so much of this cow, doodh, gaya bhas, meat, non-meat, Hindu, Muslim, veggie, non-veggie stuff. I don't even know if you want to spend time on it, or do we want to work?
No, very quickly, just fleetingly, given that we've talked about very important things like the economy of Kashmir, admittedly in passing, not in any great detail or with any great sense of expertise, we should give this equal treatment. So there's a guy whose political affiliations are known. He's suddenly contesting that milk is a vegetarian product while an egg isn't. This is, I think this takes me back to another episode we had done where the BJP minister thought that man had descended from monkey.
Remember
when we did monkey to man where everybody had come from Hanuman? Some weird thing he had put out.
He was challenging Darwin. He was saying that I don't believe in evolution because nobody has ever seen a monkey become a man. His point is that he doesn't understand evolution. His point is that, dekho, boss, monkey, and as you had pointed out, that it was, his mindset was Bikram Betal, that, there will be a monkey and someone will say, chu mantar, jadu mantar, or eem breem, something, some tantric rubbish. and a monkey will become a man. And his point is, if it won't happen, then Darwin is wrong. Evolution is wrong.
This Darwin, so milk and egg is one thing, same radius, same kind of thing. But there's another guy who made pronouncement that, you know, Newton didn't know mathematics. So something like that. You know,
he said that, so it was bizarre because I have someone on the Twitter feed mentioned that that was a distraction just to, you know, get the media for 2 days to stop talking about the economy. So that's Piyush Goyal, who's, I don't know what minister he is now. Nirmala Sitharaman is the finance minister. Piyush Goyal was what? He wasn't railways. So I don't know what portfolio he's handling now, but he's the treasurer for the BJP and he's a very smart cookie. I mean, this is a very, very smart man, you know, with an impeccable academic record and a very accomplished person as a chartered accountant and so on. But again, I think someone whose assets have also increased very significantly since the BJP came to power. So his point was that, look, the numbers look bad, but the math of the economy doesn't really indicate anything about how the economy is doing. And my point is, like, dude, I can understand you saying that society is complex and social issues can't be measured entirely. But if there's one discipline that has gone, like, you know, quant with a nuclear sort of force in the last, you know, 35, 40 years, it's basically economics. Economics, I mean, in the field, economics is sort of highly, highly mathematical and, you know, all the indices of the economy are like numbers. So his point is that math cannot tell us anything. And he said that Einstein discovered gravity without knowledge of math. Okay, first of all, obviously Einstein didn't discover gravity. But secondly, the fact of the matter also is that Einstein's mathematical ability was formidable enough that he could have, you know, he would have been known as a genius had he just focused on the math. I mean, those equations are extraordinarily difficult to prove. So he had to have been a very, very good mathematician also. So I think Goyal's so smart. I mean, I don't know if...
What do you think is Goyal is basically kind of throwing this out so that, you know, everybody talks about this?
I have maintained this for a long time that, you know, we've done lots of stories about these RSS pronouncements. And I have maintained for a long time that the Hindu right as a whole, and especially the BJP government, they are very comfortable with this. They don't mind it. Because here's the thing, that if the RSS at periodic intervals plays this role of being these ignorant, bumbling clods, you know, people laugh at them, but they also then sort of tend to feel that, hey, these guys can't be that dangerous because of their stupidity and incompetence. And that's one thing. And the second thing is that it always provides a kind of sideshow to, you know, the barbaric stuff that's happening, like either lynchings or, you know, or just the complete ineptitude, which... You know, even, I mean, what they've done with the economy has had very, very severe human costs. So I don't think this was a goof up. I mean, I think that, you know, it was just meant to be a bit of a sideshow. It's obviously not going to stop people talking about the economy completely, but it's going to give them a breather because, you know, sure enough, like for one day, even for a day and a half or two, if the headlines move away from a bunch of things which show the BJP in very bad light, that helps the BJP. I mean, I should just very quickly mention one thing, and I'm sorry, I know I'm kind of going on and on in a monologue. So there was this case of a young Muslim man, Tabrez Ansari, who was lynched by a Hindu mob. And what happened is that the findings of the medical examiners, the doctors, said that his, you know, post-mortem showed completely that he was lynched. I mean, he was beaten. It's very gruesome stuff. His skull was battered. It shows that it was, you know, he was attacked with force. But the police or the judiciary or whoever is investigating it, the state agency in question, have come out saying they've used the doctor's report and they've come out saying that he died of cardiac arrest. Now, immediately after he said this, the doctors have come out and said, no, we never said he died of cardiac arrest. This is a falsehood. Now, Times Now, which has been one of the most pro-establishment papers, in fact, they have partly, I see them responsible for this monster of Modi and Shah, even they have run a story essentially saying that, hey, hang on a minute, you know, this doesn't add up. What these people are saying is that this was a Hindu mob which killed him, and obviously something shady is going on. So when you actually have this very rare occurrence when an out-and-out pro-establishment practical mouthpiece of the government is doing this, I think the BJP needs to create some diversions and distractions.
Okay. Well, look, this is a theory that you're putting forward. So we talked about three things. We talked Kashmir, we talked about economy, Kashmir, and this guy talking about milk is vegetarian, which I think is, we've established that it's in the same ballpark as, you know, man evolved. I don't believe that man evolution to monkey and this the discovery of gravity, Einstein, without doing it without math. The final thing that we wanted to touch upon today was this haunting competition, right? So this is a story that came to this guy in Surat who wants to organize the competition. He's been picked up by Times of India, and essentially it says that whoever wins, whoever has the stinkiest fart, will get a prize money, right? Now, I do not know whether this is for real, right? But given that this is Surat, it could be possible, you know. And I think what is interesting is when I was as a child, I thought any joke that involved shit and farts was hilarious, right? But I left that behind. By the time I was about 9 and 10, my humor had improved. What I think is happening is there are certain groups of people, right, whose humor is kind of lapsing backwards, right? And I think if you're organizing a competition around bodily functions, right, it's only a matter of time before you know whose shit is a piece of artwork, or, you know, can you pee standing up? Or the different types of variants will emerge if you're doing farting competition. I know it's a strange one to talk about, but what's your view on
this? I know, I just say, you know, when I read it, I just think this guy's pulling a fast one on everyone because it's just bizarre. Like, he says that, you know, what happened is that, he said a few weeks ago, I was watching television with my family members and, you know, I caught a loud one or something. And, you know, there was laughter and shame. And he said that, why should there be shame? Because it's a natural bodily function. And then he makes these very bizarre historical claims. And this, I don't know, Bhante, tell me if this was your experience of India. He says, till about 2 decades ago, there was no shame in farting in public in India. It was, you know, it was, I don't know what he's saying. Some like, is this some Ayurvedic funda that, dude, you don't like trap it because, you know, it could, I mean, it could like injure your health or something?
No, I think he's yearning back to a golden age of bodily functions where, you know, you could fart without fear, right? I don't think in my mind that existed.
Yeah.
I
want to respect cultural difference. I want to respect cultural specificity. If that was the case in Surat, then, you know, we need to maybe respect that. That's maybe our ignorance. Maybe it was part of some elaborate, you know, Surti tradition or something.
But I think it is a bizarre story that we've done. And I think, you know, because you said, let's do something different this week. Let's try and touch on different things that have been circulating around India through this week. I think we've gone from the kind of very dark to the very bizarre. And I think that's a very interesting cycle to have done. And we'll see what our listeners think about it. And I know we are kind of racking up the time, Rohit. So with that, yeah, I'll hand you over to the last word.
Yeah, no, I'll wrap it up also. So I hope you guys like this. I mean, this is, as I said, something new we've started, just another week in India. And we know that, like, you know, a week in India is probably what as exciting in some ways, which may not always be a good thing, or as interesting as, you know, you're in, you know, some place like, dull place like Austria or something. But, you know, I think on that note, we'll wrap this up and we'll be back again. And next week we'll continue doing this. And then we'll also do our episodes, which are sort of theme-based and tend to be, you know, focused on one topic as always. Okay. So, yeah, that's it. Over and out from me, Bhante. Any other thoughts?
Take care. No, that's enough, boss.
So
take care, and thanks for. It's great to catch up.
Okay, as always, take care, man. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Rohit and Bhante would like to sign off. Please stay tuned. Follow us on India Explained on Twitter. Keep listening. Thank you for all your support.